Turing, Cambridge, 1936, and Bletchley Park, 1942. There had been some efforts to build a computer in 1820s England, but the prevailing technology of steam engines and ball bearings and metal cogs was too crude ever to make it work. The failure was not just in technology, but in imagination. Even a full century later, in the 1920s, there were many ingenious machines in the world. There were locomotives and assembly lines, and telephones and airplanes. But each did only one thing. Everyone accepted the idea that to get a different task done, you needed to build a different machine. Everyone was wrong. Alan Turing was the man who first showed, in persuasive detail, how it would be possible to change that. His life ended in tragedy, for although he conceived a perfect, clearly describable computer, and although the new insights about how electrons can leap or seemingly stop might have allowed him to construct it, the technology remained elusive. New ideas in science don't automatically produce new machines. He would be lauded in death, but not while he lived. As a boy, in the 1910s and early 1920s, Alan Turing loved the way he could think his way out of problems. He had trouble distinguishing right and left, so he dabbed a red dot on his left thumb, and then was proud that he could get around as well as other children his age. Soon he could out-navigate both children and adults. At a picnic in Scotland, to get his father's approval for being suitably brave and adventurous, he found wild honey for the family by drawing the vector lines along which nearby honeybees were flying and charting their intersection to find the hive. But as an adolescent, and then as a young adult, he found it harder and harder to blend in. By the time he was 16, he realized that he was physically attracted to men, which was tough enough. But he also realized he was without question an intellectual, and in 1920s England, especially at its private schools, that was even worse. His father was far enough away, serving in India with the civil service, not to have to pay much attention, but his mother, who was from a proper upper-middle-class background, would have none of it. Alan was a normal boy, she insisted, who would one day learn to control his strange musings on beauty, consciousness, and above all, on science. She was sure he would also, as he seems to have dutifully suggested in his letters from prep school, quite soon bring back for a visit one of those pretty girls he hoped to meet at nice London parties. Instead, by age 17, he'd fallen in love with an older boy at his school, Christopher Morcombe. They built telescopes and peered out of their dormitory windows late at night. They read physics books together and talked about stars, mortality, quantum mechanics, and free will. In their discussions, they usually didn't agree, Alan happily wrote, which made things much more interesting. But then, just a few months after they met, Morcombe died of tuberculosis. Turing seems to have lost whatever religious faith he once had after that. He angrily dropped the usual Edwardian belief that only the body is lost in death, and that an immortal soul, not made of any earthly substance, lives on. Morcombe was gone. People who tried to comfort him by saying his friend somehow survived were liars. That anger, that belief in cold materialism, was indispensable for the great electrical device that Turing imagined just a few years later. It's hard to conceive of creating an artificial device that duplicates human thinking if you believe in an immortal soul. The perishable stuff that the computer has to be made of, the wires or electrons or whatever, will lack all semblance of that soul. But if you're sure, with all the anger of adolescence, that nothing but dead earth is what remains when we die, then cold wires will do just as well as any living being. For several years, Turing acted the part of a contented Cambridge undergraduate, but he often turned to the Morcombe family when he was stressed, either through visits or heartfelt letters to Christopher's mother. Eventually, to his Cambridge friend's puzzlement, he began repeatedly quoting a line from Disney's new Sleeping Beauty movie about the poisoned apple and how quickly biting it could produce eternal rest. Early in the summer of 1935, when Turing was 22, he came across the problem that triggered his major work. It dated back to the turn of that century when, at a lecture hall in Paris on a hot August day, the great German mathematician David Hilbert had read out loud what he considered the most important mathematical problems for the 20th century. A follow-up of one of the hardest problems, still unsolved when Turing heard of it, dealt with a deep problem in logic, asking how certain long chains of reasoning could be carried out. Most researchers assumed the answer would come with an abstract mathematical proof. Turing, however, had always liked to tinker. He was excellent at building radios, fixing bicycles, and putting together metal contraptions of almost any sort. Now, as he lay in a meadow in a small town near Cambridge after one of his long, solitary afternoon runs, he imagined an actual machine that could crank through the steps of Hilbert's logical problem. All that the machine's operator would have to do was write down, very clearly, the instructions he wanted it to follow. The machine wouldn't have to understand what those instructions meant. It would simply have to execute them. Turing proved that almost any action he could imagine, adding numbers or drawing a picture, could be translated into simple logical steps that a machine could follow. It was a stunning intellectual achievement, but also a lonesome one. This universal machine, which Turing described in his 1937 paper for the Proceedings of the London Mathematical Society, was self-contained and entirely without emotion. If it was fed the right instructions, then, from that point on, it could operate on its own, forever. The machine wouldn't even need an operator to reach inside and change it when the tasks it faced changed, for Turing had also begun developing the concept of software. He realized his machine wouldn't be useful if it had to be rebuilt each time it was given a new problem to work on. Instead, he imagined that the inner parts of the machine could simply be rearranged as needed. This software might seem to be part of the solid substance of the computer, but it would really be constantly shifting around, configuring itself in one restless way, then another.